And yo, what is a cipher?
You listen to a record one time and you figured it all out, you got it, you know what it is, and you're done with it. So then you regret purchasing it.
Yeah. The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from? The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotaro. This is episode 231, a conversation with Skyzoo about his new album, In Celebration of Us. Skyzoo is a fantastic Brooklyn rapper whose sophisticated lyrics and ear for soulful beats has long made him one of our favorites. Regular listeners will no doubt remember that he's been a guest on the show twice before, but this is different. Sky approached me last month with the idea of having an in-depth conversation to tease out the themes and ideas in his awesome new record. In Celebration of Us, easily his most topical project to date, deals with police violence, gentrification, discrimination, validation, and ultimately what it means to be, as Sky is, a black man raising a black boy in America today. He wanted to have the talk at a place near to his heart. We met at Mike's Coffee Shop, a Brooklyn diner that has been a staple of his life since childhood, and remains one now that he has a child, his newborn son Miles, of his own. I met Skyzoo at Mike's on a cold, late January afternoon. If you like The Cipher, please check out our Patreon at patreon.com/thecipher show. Every new patron helps bring Josh a little closer to scoring a game-worn Porzingis jersey. Also, we know some of you want shirts and other stuff, so please go to merch.thecyphershow.com and get yourself a mug or something. Use the coupon code THECIPHERLAUNCH for a decent discount. If you want to know any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list and the show notes. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what's going on with The Cipher. And now, here's the king of homophones, Skyzoo.
Oh, man.
All right. Well, I'd expect good coffee from a place called Mike's Coffee Shop.
Yeah, man. Yeah. Absolutely. Welcome. Yeah. Welcome to the neighborhood, man.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Where are we exactly?
So this is like borderline Bed-Stuy Clinton Hill. Mm. And over the years, it's been debated on whether it's the Stuy or whether it's Clinton Hill. Once the line got moved, gentrification, whatever, changing the neighborhood. But this is, you know, where I grew up for a large portion of my life. It's where people know me to be from, even when I moved around after that or whatever it may be. This is my neighborhood, you know what I mean? So this is St. James. But when you get across the street, it becomes Hall. So same thing, but this is St. James, DeKalb. This is Mike's. Been coming here for years, since a little kid, breakfast. You know, the whole deal. They open mad early, and then they close mad early. You know what I mean? So they've been around forever. You can look at the walls, and been around forever, man. You know, I shouted them out on that record, especially like 9-5 Bad Boy logo.
Yeah.
I said grew up between Mike's and Country House. Mike's is better. The lights is better.
When he told you T-bone steak, cheese, eggs, and Welch's grape, I grew up between Mike's and Country House. Mike's is better. The lights is better when you underneath. You light up whoever when you want to eat.
And look, this is Mike's, you know.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
Nice.
Every weekend I'm here. So.
Yeah, even now.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, we're here obviously to talk about In Celebration of Us,
yeah,
the new album, which is really incredible.
Thank you, brother.
And, you know, I guess I wanted to start with the most basic thing, which is the title. So what is the title?
So title-wise, I wanted to make an album that was super about us. And when I say us, I mean people who look like me, move like me, live like me, et cetera, et cetera. So us, in the sense of my people, per se, right? So it's celebrating us in every fashion, in every way, shape, or form. The things that make us who we are as a people, as a culture, as a society, as a race, you know, it celebrates us, but on all sides. So I feel like the things that have happened to us to make us the way we are, things that we do ourselves, because we're not perfect just like no one else is, you know? So the things we do to ourselves that shape us and make us the way we are, good, bad, or indifferent. But a lot of times, even those things that we do to ourselves are due to what was done to us. So it's the domino effect, right?
Yeah.
But it's celebrating us. The highs, the lows, the ups, the downs, all the reasons for all that. It's celebrating us, you know? So that's where the title came from.
You deal with that in a lot of ways over the course of the record, which we'll get into.
Yeah.
But when you were talking about this record, the statement you put out, there was a phrase in it that kind of puzzled me that I was hoping you could break down. Mm-hmm. You said that one of the things the record is about mm-hmm. the irony of motives behind bigger motives.
Right.
And that was a phrase that kind of turned my head around a little bit.
Can you
tell me a little bit about that was?
Yeah, like
what that is, how it relates to the record?
Behind, so again, it explains, you know, who we are, where we are, and like I said, the things that we do to ourselves. But when you really dig deeper, it's based on things that were done to us. Like, it started there. Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of the things I wanted to cover on the album, out of all the topics, one of the topics was validation, you know, and I'm sure down the line we'll go into it more, but validation was a very, very big part of the project, conceptually, right? So I feel like as a people, we're always, whether we realize it or not, whether we know it or not, we're searching for validation. It's the reason why we put so much importance on certain things that other types of people from different walks of life, different economic backgrounds, different races, skin colors, may not put as much importance and as much value on. Mm-hmm. It's the reason why people wonder, well, why do they live in these certain neighborhoods but buy $200 Jordans? It's validation. It's wanting to feel like you matter. Mm-hmm. Why do they care about feeling like they appear to matter so much? Well, if you go back 400 or 500 years, if you were this color, you were allowed to be in the house because it was okay to be around these kids because you mattered a little more than those who were darker, who weren't allowed in the house, who had to be in the field. So it's all validation. It's all mattering and being important or feeling like you're important, feeling like you do matter. It's all validation. So that's a part of it, you know. So when I talk about the motives behind motives, like the motives behind bigger motives, you know, our motives for moving a certain way may be based on the motives that were behind us being put in certain positions to make us move a certain way hundreds of years later, decades later, whatever it may be. Yeah. And that's what it all comes down to, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there's this great moment in one of the songs where you kind of set up, not exactly a contrast, but mention after the other, DOC, Department of Corrections, and then someone being a doctor mm-hmm. and someone getting a doctorate.
Right,
and
right,
sort
right.
of throw them all in a line.
Yeah.
Well, you in a hall, up on the wall with Department of Correction, letters hovered up over where your name is. Or you by the door, tapping down to the floor. 8 years of proof hovered up over where your name sit. Draw you to the crown, they sell it to you as weightless. They charge you to sit on a wait list. And you fast forward, private park in the Porsche, open the doors to a round of applause down the hall from all your patients. Fist in the air.
Seems to relate to some of the stuff you're talking about.
Super
here.
Dope that you caught that, bro.
Yeah.
Super dope. You know what I mean? Like, you called it out right away, you know. Your name, correction letters, holding up your sign because you just got booked, you know, and then being a doctor, going to school for that, graduating that, cap and gown to the floor, 8 years of proof hovered up over where your name is, like, you know, your diploma, your name, doctorate of, congratulations, master's, bachelor's, whatever it is, 8 years getting your master's, med school, whatever it is.
Yeah.
You nailed it. Absolutely.
So, we are in Brooklyn, obviously, and one of the themes of this album that comes up a lot is gentrification, which is something you've talked about before on other projects. We've actually talked about it, the two of us, other times we've met. What's new in that? What's changed in your thinking about kind of gentrification and specifically about Brooklyn over maybe the past, you know, 3-5 years?
Nothing's really changed as far as my thought and my outlook on it. I still feel the way I feel. The one side and the other side. What has changed within the scheme and the scope of it is what it is, like just how prevalent it is and how much harder it's hitting every day. Mm. And for the record, you know, I don't have a problem with gentrification. I don't have a problem with different types of people from different walks of life moving into my neighborhood or neighborhoods like mine. Mm-hmm. What I have a problem with is the ills that come with it based on some of the attitudes and agendas of those people that move into the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. You know, like if you moved in my neighborhood, I have no problem with that. You know what I mean? You're a mega cool dude, very intelligent dude. I have no problem with that. You know what it is, who you are, who those are around you, and there's a mutual respect and admiration and different things like that for different cultures, whatever, whatever, and different walks of life. That's great. I live in a neighborhood, same neighborhood I always grew up in. I live in a neighborhood where you walk in your dog, people who don't look like you are walking their dog, and you nod and say hi, or the dogs start interacting, and they act like you're not there, and they don't speak to you. But when you nod and say hello, they look straight ahead, or they look at you and then look ahead. as if you're not supposed to be there. And that's where the confusion comes in, because I say, wait a minute, you guys are all welcome into our neighborhoods. It's totally fine. Don't act like we were never here. Mm-hmm. Don't act like we're not supposed to be here. We were here first. We were here when nobody wanted to be here. You know, I remember being in junior high, and I always went to schools in different neighborhoods that weren't near my neighborhood, right? My parents always wanted me to go to better schools. So I always went to school in Manhattan or Brooklyn Heights, Borough Hill, things like that. And I remember being in junior high, going to school in Chelsea, and my friends who didn't look like me wouldn't come to my neighborhood after school to hang out because their parents told them, don't go over there. Right. Now those same kids live in my neighborhood, you know what I mean? Because it's changed so much, so drastically. So at the end of the day, I say all that to say, we've been here. So when you come in, enjoy it with us. Don't try to enjoy us and push us out, whether it's figuratively, whether it's literally. Don't try to enjoy us and push it. Don't try to enjoy what we have and push us out of it. Just enjoy it with us.
Right. You know what I mean? And on top of that, kind of don't bring your stereotypes of who you think I am into your neighborhood. You have this great thing that happens at the beginning and then at the end of one of the songs on the album involving a city bike.
Thought of who here now, interrupting a cell, or pulling up on a city bike and wanting some krills. It's all basic, Venmo begging, call it...
Can you break that down for me?
It's a very, very true thing that happened. So in my neighborhood, I live around the corner from some projects, and I remember one day walking my dog. If you follow me on the gram, you know my dog, because he's all over it. I'm walking my dog one day, and I saw, you know, the city bikes in New York, a real thing. It's prevalent. They're everywhere. You put your card in, you get a bike, whatever, whatever. And I remember seeing a white dude, probably was in his mid to late 30s, going to the P's, going to the projects, with a dude who probably was in his early 20s, hoodie on, the whole deal. Two people who you would never think would interact with one another, opening the door for the white dude on the city bike. And I saw him go in with his city bike in the building. And I said, let me see where this goes. And me and my dog stood on the corner for 30 seconds. And the dude came out, taking his hand out of his pocket. So I knew what it was. Right. I knew it was a sale, right? Blew me away. The coming together and the meshing of these neighborhoods and these types of people. I mean, you had a dude who probably was from middle America and moved here a couple years ago, who was purchasing, who was copping in the P's, to the point where he brought his city bike in the P's with him.
Right.
It blew me away. And I remember that. And when I started writing on the album, which that's Heirlooms and Accessories, that record, when I started writing, that record, more so than any of the other records, is solely based on gentrification and how it interacts with the inner workings of the urban community in a city where I'm from. Whether it's Brooklyn, whether it's Detroit, whether it's Chicago, Compton, whatever. And when these two things kind of mesh together and boil together, and what happens? Blew me away that this dude who looked like you was going to see a dude who looked like me and brought his city bike in the P's.
It's almost too perfect a metaphor, right?
Exactly.
It's almost like, I can't believe this is literally
30 seconds walked outside. Yeah. I knew what it was. Oh, he just purchased. You know what I mean? And it blew me away, you know? And I felt the world needed to hear that, so I painted the scene in different ways with that record.
Yeah. You were talking about aspirations a minute ago, and one of the big images you used to talk about aspirations throughout the record is a convertible, right? The idea of a roof being gone, a top being off.
Right. Said to make owning a roof part of a habit, but learned that sitting in rooms that didn't have them. Heard that is getting your roof was all that mattered. All at the lip off the roof. Could you imagine the irony of the top being behind you? Be at the...
Can you break that down for me a little bit?
Yeah, so I felt like we're taught so much about when we grow up, especially where I'm from, we admire those older than us. I feel like in any neighborhood you always do, right? Like the girl admires her older sister or whatever it is. So in my neighborhood, you admire the guys older than you who have more, who've done more, who move around, cool guys in the neighborhood, guys who got the money, the girls, whatever, whatever. And it was all about being taught. If you got good advice from the OGs in your neighborhood, being taught to change your surroundings, being taught that the roof is higher than you may think as far as where you can go. It may not be taught in the same way as school may teach it, or the Bible may teach it, or whatever religion or spiritual side you're on, but the idea of the roof is higher than it may seem, and how to change the room that you're in. But we learned that in rooms that didn't have roofs. i.e. the park, which the record is Parks and Recreations. So we were taught to change the roof of the room that we're in, meaning change our surroundings, better places, better this, better that, and the third. But the irony of learning about how to change the room you're in a room that's not really a room, meaning you're outside all night, you're outside all day, all night when you shouldn't be, but you're learning so much about life and how to move forward and change the room that you're in, whether it's legally or illegally as far as how you go about it. You learn so much about a room and a roof coming off in a room that doesn't have a roof, which is the park. So this is the irony of it.
And potentially maybe one day being able to afford a nice convertible.
Absolutely. And then you get to the literal sense of that. Absolutely. Right. So it's figurative. It's literal. 100%.
Yeah. And, you know, first, congratulations on your new son.
Oh, thank
Miles,
you, man. Yeah.
New father. How's fatherhood treating you?
It's amazing, man. It makes you not want to leave the house. You know, it makes you... Everything changes. I've always heard those stories, right? I've always heard people say, when you have a kid, it changes your life. And I knew that was a real thing. There's no reason to believe 100% of the people who say that would be wrong. I've never heard nobody with a kid.
They're not all lying.
Right. Yeah. I've never heard nobody with a kid not say that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So there's no reason to believe 100% of the population would be wrong about that.
Yeah.
But I just didn't know what that felt like. And then seeing them and hearing them and holding them, it's insane. It's insanity. The only thing, obviously, is the sleep factor.
Sure.
He loves 3 a.m. Right. And I'm like, word. But other than that, you know, it's amazing. And when I was creating the album...
I was going to say, he was on the way.
Right.
While you
Absolutely.
Were creating this.
And when I found out that he was a he, I said, I'm about to raise a young black boy and have to turn him into a black man.
Mm.
Here we go. And the responsibilities and the pressures continued to mount. Granted, it would have been exactly the same if it was a girl, because in this world, women obviously have it harder than men. But being a black man, raising a black boy, and turning him into a black man successfully is a very, very difficult thing to do. And I think it's a very underrated job. And as someone who always had his father in his life, that's the blueprint that I use for everything with Miles. You know what I mean? Everything, you know? And... someone who had his father every single day, clearly I'm going to 100% do the exact same thing. And everything kind of just changes. So with the music, the album really became about him. You know, I had this idea, celebration of us as a people, as black folk, who we are, what we are, where we are, and how we are, right? None of that changed, but what added on to it was I wanted to turn the album into a guide for him.
Yeah.
Said to myself, like a how-to book, right? You look at how to do this, how to do that. The album, I wanted it to act as a how-to guide for him. So he would know what to expect, what to not accept, what to not tolerate, how to move in this world, how to be in this world, how to survive in this world to the best of his abilities. Let this be kind of a tool or a lesson guide, you know, like a guidebook. Let this be cliff notes. Let this be something of that sort. To say, hey, this is what it is. This is what to expect. Being who you are, being the gender you are, the color you are, you know, being in this world, being where you're from, being from where you're from, and how to maneuver within it, how to survive in it. This album is solely with him in mind, and it's for him. You know, it's dedicated to him 100%.
And the album opens with an imagined conversation between your father and one of his friends.
Caught that, yep.
Yeah.
What's up, G? Yo, kid, Lisa pregnant. We got a boy coming. I'm about to be a pop, yo.
Get the fuck out of here. For real? Yo, Greg, congrats, brother. That's dope, for real.
Yeah, good looking out, good looking out. We naming him Skyler.
So that's my father and my godfather. That's two dudes I had playing my father and my godfather. 1982, the year I was born, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. Why start the album that way?
Once I knew Miles was on the way, I was working on Peddler Themes, and I started that album with a woman playing my mother.
Between me and his father, I think we're doing good with him. We're raising him right, but we know the truth is, it's like, when my son goes outside, I know where he is, but I don't know where he is. I know what he is.
So I knew when I did that, I was going to continue the story playing with my father. So I had a woman playing my mother, talking about, you know, raising a boy. You know, me and his father do everything that we can do, and we do our best. When he goes outside, whatever happens, happens. And then she closes the album as well. It talks about what it's like raising a boy as a mother, as a woman.
His father and I did our part. The issue, though, is you can control what happens in your house, but you can't control outside. Your hands are tied when it comes to that. And
being in a certain neighborhood, living where you live, being the type of individual you are, and how to successfully do this, what you have control over and what you don't. I wanted to continue that dialogue with the father's point of view and my father and what he had to go through to raise me as a young dude. My father had me, he was 20, you know, my father was 20, my mother was 19. So they were kids, you know, and when I was a little kid, I thought they was, you know, old as dirt, you know what I mean? But when I look back, I'm like, yo, if I was 22 with a two-year-old, I don't know what I would have done, you know what I mean? But they did it. They figured it out successfully, you know? So going back to your point, I wanted to really shed light on that. In this climate where we are, whether we talk politics, whether we talk police brutality, whether we talk gentrification, whether we talk economics, whatever it is, being a black male, it's harder than it's ever been. This is how important it is for young black boys to have black fathers in their lives. You know, it takes a man to raise a boy. It takes a woman to raise a girl. I can't teach a little girl how to grow up and be the best woman she could be. I can't do that. I would be failing her by attempting to do that on my own or being attempting to say, this is how you do this and how it is to be a woman. I don't know what it's like to be a woman. So on the flip side, black boys need their father, you know, and I don't think that gets projected as much as it should. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to tie that in with the album, with race, with police brutality, with gentrification, all the different things that I'm speaking about. I wanted to tie that in with it because it is a very central part of the conversation. Right. A lot of things could change if fathers was around, you know?
Yeah, so that kind of comes, it's not literally addressed again until the very end of the album.
Exactly.
When you have, you know, this scene of you and your father watching a movie. And, you
watching
know,
Boys in the Hood.
Yeah, yep. Watching Boys in the Hood. Yeah.
Then there was a kid watching all of the above with his pops in the theater, and it caught him like a drug. He was hooked on the idea of wondering if son should have stayed to the end and started talking with his gun because he felt...
Which is a movie that mirrored your own life to a certain extent.
100%. You know, as a kid, you know, I remember having the conversation because my parents were split. So I remember having the conversation. And as a kid, you know, I remember having a conversation with my mother. And my parents were always split, but I always had them every single day, no doubt about it. And I remember having a conversation with her where she was like, I'm about to get a second job, et cetera, et cetera. First of all, I can't leave you home by yourself at 10 years old, but also I can't teach you the things you need to know now. You know, at a young age, I can teach you how to express emotion, how to be lovable, how to be considerate, how to be kind, how to have manners. I can do those things. I can't teach you what it's like to be a man out here in Brooklyn, New York. Only your father can. So you need to spend more time with him and a little less time with me. And years later, I knew that was a conversation between my mother and my father that my father had obviously spearheaded, saying, hey, it's my turn.
Right.
Turn around, Boys in the Hood comes out. I'm like, this is exactly what just happened to me, you know, where they had the conversation. And I remember telling my mother, but I see daddy all the time. Like, what do you mean? I didn't understand it. I was like, nah, it's a difference between seeing him all the time and literally being up under him 24/7 for the most part.
Right.
And it spoke volumes, and it was something that I needed to happen. And, you know, all of my friends were in similar positions. I preached that to them. And, you know, the story of Trey and Furious was very, very similar to my father and I. It was very similar to him teaching me certain things, me having friends like, you know, Ricky and Doughboy and Chris and, you know, all of them.
Yeah.
Me having friends like that who they didn't have fathers, and I did. And then when you fast forward 15, 20 years, whatever it is, the difference is. And I remember when Furious was like, you're going to see where they end up. And I could sit here and say the same thing as far as some of my friends, not all, but some of my friends in my life, you know, and it just speaks volumes. So when I was writing that record, Honor Amongst Thieves, that part hit. And I was like, I really want to spotlight what that was, but do it in a creative way. So where I tell the story, there was a story of a kid who had his father every day, and then I tell a story about Boys in the Hood.
Story of a kid who had his father every day, and his father had the
grip, but he also had a name, or for more than just a grip. It was all for how he changed, and it was all because his kid wasn't supposed to be the same. But the story of his friends was from off a different page, so his father was the difference under all that he became. But he still.
And then I turned that into, there's a kid in the theater looking up, there, and it just keeps going. It's like, oh, okay, and then it just keeps pulling the thread and pulling the covers back, you know?
Yeah. And why put that last? Why have that be, you know, other than your ending monologue, have that be, you know, literally the last verse you hear on the record?
Well, I felt like it tied everything up, mm-hmm. especially with it starting with the skit of my father and my godfather.
Right.
You know, my father telling my godfather, yo, I got a son on the way. I'm about to change everything I've been on. Yeah. And then everything that happens in between, and then it ends with, here's what happened, here's how he changed everything.
Yeah.
Putting his son in schools that weren't in the neighborhood, making sure his son did this, that, and the third, mm-hmm. telling his son, look, I've been outside, I know what it's like to be in dangerous situations, hazardous situations, I know what it's like to be that guy. So when you decide to be that guy, make sure you know what comes with being that guy. And as long as I'm here, I'm not gonna let you get but so far into knowing what's what and as far as that world. And also, it seems people nowadays have an infatuation with playing albums backwards.
Oh, Lamar. Hail Mary, your marijuana times is hard.
Shortly after the release of Kendrick Lamar's 2017 album, Damn, fans began experimenting with playing the album in reverse order and seeing how that changed the record's narrative. In an interview with Rolling Stone, Lamar confirmed that the idea of playing the LP in reverse was something he thought about when creating it, and eventually a collector's edition of Damn with a new order was officially released.
So, if you were to play the album backwards, it serves the same purpose. Because you could play it and say, okay, it starts with me talking about my father, talking about how I grew up. And you could literally play the whole album backwards if you wanted to, and it ends with my father and my godfather talking about me, having me, what's going on. So when you go backwards, it's like, okay, this is who he is. Oh, this is how that all started. Or you could say this is how it started. Oh, this is why he is who he is. Mm. Since people have an infatuation with saying, you know, flipping an album and making it go backwards, we could do that too,
right.
You know?
The police violence, racist police violence,
absolutely.
Black Lives Matter movement,
absolutely.
Pervades this record.
Mm-hmm.
But in some ways, you mention it a lot, but it is sort of, I don't quite know how to say this, but it's never exactly direct. There's not, you know, here is Skyzoo's take on police violence,
absolutely.
Right? It's, oh, he said the word matter, and then he said the words black lives, right? Like
right,
you
right,
do that
yeah.
one time.
I need a dot in the beam on whatever matters. Black lives and black fives, the frame boxing out. I'm Luke Cajun, but more related to Cottonmouth. And we related to...
Right.
Or you will mention things like the Eric Garner case or the Philando Castile case.
Absolutely.
And not say their names.
Right.
The prestige of feeling like you who they let breathe due to a bag that you shouldn't have. It just seems like more than they letting on to. And they ask you what an automatic out of rights. Facebook live panorama with your life. And that view goes from the cameras to the lights till they tell son that he had to be right. You never prove them wrong, right?
Why approach it like that?
Poetic. I like to write, whether it's this album or anything I've ever done or anything I'll do moving forward. For me, it's all about the art of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing to say, it's raining outside. It's another thing to talk about what it really is and describe it in a more artistic and poetic way, get the same point across, but really have something more dense to it and more layer to it, especially in a business where people don't purchase the way they should. I always get asked, how come your records are so complex and so layered and so double and triple entendre? Well, I feel like I'm doing you a service by giving you more for your money.
Right.
If you listen to a record one time and you figured it all out, you got it, you know what it is, then you're done with it. So then you regret purchasing it. So the next time around, you're not going to purchase because you're going to say, I can figure that out right away. Let me just go on one of these sites and download it for free.
Right.
But you know what a record of mine, a year, 5 years, I've even heard 10 years later, people are still getting things from it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what records like Illmatic did for me. That's what records like Ready to Die and obviously Reasonable Doubt and different things did for me as a listener coming up, where you can listen 20 plus years later and still get stuff from it. So I'm carrying that tradition on. So that's more broad. But going back to your direct question,
yeah.
That's why, you know, I describe certain things in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
But like you said, this album, the mentions of police brutality and things like that are more prevalent and direct than I've ever done. You
right.
know, with this, it's me literally saying, you know, all these green lives, black lives, blue lives, you know, green lives, I'm talking about money, blue lives, I'm talking about
that green lives, you know, thing, I mean? By the way, took me like two or three listens to figure out, by the way.
I know that all of these green lives that used to be here matter like these black lives that these blue lives shoot out of fear. So all these green lives used to
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it, bro.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess talk about that a little bit in terms of, like, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement. Obviously, there's been, you know, people advocating against racist police violence for as long as there have been police. But it wasn't until, you know, Michael Brown, until like 2014, that it started becoming a movement.
Yeah, him and Trayvon and
And when that first started kind of bubbling up, you know, 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago, how did that hit you? How did you react to it?
It hit me the way it's always hit me as a kid. You know, I grew up in a house where my father was outside and known for being outside, but my father also had a plethora of books in the house, and he was panthered out. You know what I mean? He wasn't technically a Black Panther. I wouldn't put that out there, disrespect people who were not in it. But he was that. Like, he was all about that. And he raised me with that. He raised me to know who I am, what I'm about, and how to move about life, being proud of who I am and where I'm from. So all of that speaks volume. So I've always been aware of that type of stuff. It always hit me as a kid the same way it hit me nowadays. But I think when you're older, obviously you understand more, but when you're older and it happens to youth, it's going to hit you a certain way, obviously, as well. And I just wanted to really jump into that the way it deserved to be jumped into and really talk about how that's a part of, obviously, humongous part of who we are nowadays and what it's all about. You know, I feel like a lot of people are doing it, which is great, as long as it's with the right motive and intent, as long as it's done the right way. There can never be too many people raising the flag, right? There can never be too many. So if every rapper on the planet made music about that, that'd be amazing. As long as the motive and the intent is from the right place, and as long as it's done the right way, there can never be enough people raising that flag. But I just wanted to be able to do that as someone who looks the way I look, et cetera, et cetera. And it goes on in my neighborhood. I mean, there's not a day of my life in my neighborhood that I don't see police. Police presence is in my neighborhood every single day. Whether they're standing on the corner in groups of three, whether they're circling the block 10 times in a 15-minute period, every single day I see police. Whether they're zipping back and forth, running around. And every time I see police, they got their hand on their hip. For whatever reason, standing in front of the corner store, they got their hand on their hip, you know, every single day. You know, so there was no way I couldn't talk about that. Like, I'm used to being around that type of presence, and I've never been comfortable with that type of presence. For me, being who I am, being whatever type of celebrity you want to say I am or whatever it may be, I've never been comfortable around police. That's not to say that there aren't some cool police. I know some personally. You know, I got friends whose fathers is police or whatever it may be. But I am never comfortable around police until further notice, ever. It's weird where you can have an organization whose job is supposed to be to serve and protect, and then when they approach you, you don't feel protected or served at all. Right. Like, I could be as clean as a whistle, nothing in my truck, I'm driving my truck, whatever, nothing in it at all, you know? And if they're behind me, I'm nervous. If they're behind me, I'm worried. If they're behind me, I'm mad. I'm like, these punk motherfuckers want, man. You know what I mean? Like, and that's just, you know, and again, that doesn't reflect all of them. That's not to say every one of them is bad. I'm sure some of them are fans of mine. Matter of fact, I remember going to the store and seeing some outside, and one of them knew me. It was like, yo, Sky Zoo. I said, oh, okay. Like, I didn't know how to take that.
Right.
Because he was looking at me as I was parking, and I was like, here we go.
I mean, from a city with where the hip-hop police were invented, that's maybe not the most encouraging thing.
Exactly.
That's the sound of the police. That's the sound.
In the early 2000s, the NYPD formed a special branch within its gang investigation unit to monitor rap artists. They are apparently still active. The New York Post reported that the so-called hip-hop cops shut down a 2 Chainz listening party in June 2017.
And it was like, you know, I'm parking his truck, and he's looking. I'm like, here we go with this shit. And then when I get out, he's like, yo, Sky Zoo. I'm like, oh, what's up? He's like, yeah, nah, I know what's up. I'm a fan. Word. Okay, appreciate it. But so that's not to say all of them on one side of the fence. But a vast majority of them are. I'm never comfortable around police.
I want to dig into the Eric Garner case for a second. As a native New Yorker, you know, I'm sure you've passed probably thousands of people on various corners selling Lucy's.
Absolutely.
Maybe even Eric himself, if you you know, have been to Staten Island or whatever.
It's actually my man's cousin.
Oh,
my man.
I thought there might be some kind of.
Yeah, my man Foof. That was his cousin.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Can you talk about how you felt when you kind of first heard?
Yeah, out? Like you said. I mean, Lucy's a Lucy. Yeah,
right.
It's 25 cents. That when I was growing up,
right.
Lucy was a quarter. You know,
yeah.
Now it's like a dollar or whatever. But yeah. Lucy was a quarter. You know, you get on the train, you'd be standing in front of the train station, packing Newport, selling Lucy. Wasn't a big deal. You know, I think. Whether it's a Lucy or a mixtape or whatever it may have been
right.
in this yeah. climate. Right.
Like the CD guy.
Exactly.
Like Sterling.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Alton Sterling, known in his city of Baton Rouge as the CD man because he sold CDs and DVDs in front of the city's Triple S Food Mart, was shot and killed by police on July 5th, 2016 in the parking lot of the store. The case became a national story because multiple bystanders caught the killing on video. The Jeff Sessions-led Department of Justice decided in May of 2017 not to charge the officers involved, and the state is still investigating.
You know,
yeah.
whatever it is, it's worth a conversation. And if you don't think it's worth a conversation, okay, you want to aim low so this person has a chance to live. And at the least bit, if you want to look at it from an extremely shallow standpoint, that's less heat on you as a cop. You know what I mean? If you feel that threatened to the point where, whether it's a Lucy or you feel that threatened, you still don't have to take a life. Aim low. Waist down. Hit somebody in the leg, they're going to drop. You have the power now. And again, I'm not campaigning for anybody to get shot.
Of course not.
Because of a seat. You know, but I'm just saying, if we want to talk about it on that level, why does it always have to go to a murder? Why does it always have to, let me get rid of this guy? If I'm that much of a threat to you physically, whether I'm bigger than you or you afraid, physical stature, whatever it is, go low.
Yeah.
You hit somebody in the knee, they're going to drop. That's it. Now you have the power. Now you can arrest them, whatever the case may be. And we know that they know that because we've seen other situations where that's happened with people who don't look like that. You know what I mean? Like, you see situations where you draw a gun and just say, hey, don't move, don't move, don't move. You could have told Eric Garner, don't move. You could have told Alt Sterling. You could have told Flannel Cash, don't move. That's it. Instead of saying don't move, they let off. And that's a different thing now. Now having a son, I mean, you look at the kid who was 17 years old playing music. Now, granted, that wasn't a cop.
On November 23rd, 2012, Jordan Davis, a black 17-year-old, was shot and killed at a gas station by a 49-year-old white man named Michael Dunn following an argument over the volume of music Davis was playing. Dunn is now serving life in prison without parole plus 90 years.
But still, you look at where there's so much fear, you know, and I talk about that on Everybody's Fine, you know, the fear in the face, this, that, and the third.
Fist in the air over mistakes, or fist in the air over the jakes, being vision impaired, holding a tray, and that tray pound lift up the fear from out his face, and you vision impaired over awake for the face that the jakes penned as being a
huge. You know, stanza with those entendres where I talk about the fear in the face of the cop who eliminates that fear by pulling out and putting fear in your face and da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
You know, it's this fear. For what reason? You know, like, for what reason? It's a fear. Okay, what gave you this fear, you know? And that's a whole different discussion.
Yeah. One of the images that comes up on the album a lot is a crown.
I've been on my new fan, crown, hold a crown, but it ain't nothing new now from how you know it. It's just like how you...
Being that we're in Brooklyn, right, the crown reminds me of Biggie, reminds me of the famous Source cover.
Mm-hmm.
The crown reminds me of Jean-Michel Basquiat of his symbol.
Big actually wore a crown on the April 1997 issue of Rap Pages, not the Source. The iconic photo was taken by Baron Claiborne. As for Basquiat, a crown frequently appears in his work. The symbol, which the artist's former lover and roommate, Suzanne Malouk, traced to his love of the Little Rascals, the show's production company, King World Productions, had a similar crown as part of its logo, was associated with the artist himself or other people he admired.
What role does the crown play on In Celebration of Us?
Knowing that we're still kings and queens no matter what, you know? Whether
which
it's,
is something close to what Basquiat.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And knowing we're still kings and queens no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of inspiration for this album, not no problem admitting it, because I love where I'm about to say it came from. A lot of inspiration from this album outside of being who I am, being from where I'm from, experiencing the things I've experienced. A lot of it came from the Solange album as well, in a sense. You know, I loved what she did on that album. And I always tell people, in a vast sense, when people, if people were to ask, oh, what's the album about, whatever, if I had to give it to you in one sentence, as opposed to this nice dialogue that we're having, yeah. I'd say it's the hip-hop version of Solange's album. That's what I would say. It's the rap version of Solange's album. You know, it's unapologetically black, but that doesn't mean that it's turning off anyone else, white or whatever it may be, you know? And one of my, not reservations, but one of the things that I wanted to be cognizant of and one of the things that I thought about when I was creating the album was, how will everyone else receive it who isn't black? You know, I know how
people. What do you think?
Well, they ain't hear it yet, so I don't know. But I think, but you know, so I can't say what the verdict is. But I think the verdict is going to be fine. You know, I think because again, it's like her mom's. It's like Solange's mom said on the record, just because you're pro-black doesn't mean you're anti-white.
It really saddens me when we're not allowed to express that pride in being black. And that if you do, then it's considered anti-white. No, you're just pro-black, and that's okay. The two don't go together. Because you celebrate black culture does not mean that you don't like white culture.
You know, at all. I mean, like, at all.
Yeah.
Just because you're celebrating yours doesn't mean you don't have an appreciation, love, or affinity, or just respect for anything else and anyone else. You know,
yeah.
There's nothing wrong with celebrating yours, you know, but that doesn't mean you're shunning anyone else's, you know. And so with the crown thing, it just comes back to who we are and where we're from, and what made us who we are. We're still kings and queens no matter what. And I would hope everyone feels that way about their own kind. That's what makes us all equal, the fact that we all could be kings and queens, you know. So I would hope that everyone feels the same way. That's how I feel about me and mine. The goal is getting a lot of mine to understand that and recognize that, appreciate that, appreciate the fact that they are that, you know? That's the problem, and that's kind of what, as far as the motives behind bigger motives, like, that's what's been done to us, you know, making us as a people feel like that isn't the truth and that isn't a reality. Mm-hmm. So you got so many kids who look like me but are younger, you know, or whatever it is, or even older, who weren't taught to believe that, mm-hmm. so they don't believe that. They think that's a facade, and all it's about is what's on TV and what you're wearing. And I'm all about what's on TV and what I'm wearing, but it doesn't define me. Right. It doesn't define who I am. It's just a part of who I am that I enjoy. It doesn't define anything about me. What defines who I am is literally who I am and how I respect, appreciate, celebrate, and represent that. You know?
It reminds me of something in Hoodie Season, which is in part about stereotypes and the effect that stereotypes have on the people they're directed at, that right. you find yourself sort of conforming to them almost without realizing.
Yeah.
And ain't no way to separate it. Ain't no room for separation. Only room to fit inside it. Room enough to be who they assume you coincide with. Like pulling on the drawstrings and running up beside it. Where it's at, like where it at, and leaving out with that beside us. Or pulling on the-
Absolutely. Hoodie Season was almost a last minute record. It was one of the last two records I did.
Yeah.
The last two records I did on albums, Hoodie Season and Baker's Dozen. And I had this idea sonically what I wanted on the album, what was left. I said, I need something that sounds and feels like this. Got the beat from Mark Infinite, and I was going to go in another direction. And I hadn't even figured out what the direction would be, but it was a different direction from Hoodie Season. But for whatever reason, the light switch just came on and said, nah, go that way. And all black draping. Drawstrings hanging, like, you know, literally, like, all black draping, drawstrings hanging, you know, and it keeps going. The importance of this garment, it's could be the most important garment of our culture as a people because of what it represents on so many levels, whether you outside hustling, whether you get preconceived connotations and you get misjudged and you get looked at a certain way because you have it on. Whether you have it on in a literal sense to literally just protect you from what's going on outside, or whether it protects you from people who may think of you one way, but if you have it on, you may look more the part. If you're outside on the corner, you may look more the part. First thing people do, they go outside on the corner the first time they put on a hoodie. So if they look the part, if it's your first day, what we call jumping off the stoop, you know, going outside to get busy and get your hands dirty, we call it jumping off the stoop. Your first time jumping off the stoop, or jumping off the steps, you put on a hoodie to look the part, right? So you're protecting yourself from anything that anyone around you who's been off the stoop for years and years may or may not think about you.
Gotcha.
And then the way it can get, the way people can perceive you because of it, as far as police, or as far as people who don't look like you and aren't from where you're from. And the fact that certain people can wear it and not be judged at all, and certain people can wear it and be judged 100%. To me, a hoodie is an extremely complex, complicated garment. And I got a million of them. And it's an extremely complicated garment that we don't really think about, you know? And it may seem kind of basic on a surface level, but when I started writing the record, it really came in and I was like, wow. You know, and there's little moments on the record where I talk about Carmelo Anthony.
I was going to say, obviously, yeah. He's referenced in the title.
Right, yeah. Exactly, and in Hoodie Season. And
bet you that it's with me if I'm fighting for a city that's electing to align with whoever's up against me. And they looking at my kind as a reason to forget me. And I'm moving like it's fine for everyone who defends me.
Carmelo Anthony was traded from Sky's beloved Knicks in September 2017. Anthony got the nickname Hoodie Mello among fans beginning that May because he was always seen wearing a hoodie through the entire spring and summer, even when working out. Hoodie Mello became so popular that the Jordan brand eventually manufactured hoodies that read Hoodie Season in tribute.
Him being Hoodie Mello and that getting him back in certain fans' good graces who thought he may not have it. Oh, he still got it because he got on this hoodie, this persona of being about it and being in the moment and tied up and boom, boom. And then you talk about how a city of people turned against him and the people who stood by him, who looked like him, and the people who sort of turned against him don't. And the way someone was put in position as far as Phil Jackson put him in a position to be turned against on. And there's just so many layers of it, you know? So that was a little drop I just wanted to throw in there on that record, too, because the name and the spelling of it, of the title, obviously came from that.
Right.
But it's really about the garment and the Trayvons and the this and the that and the guys on the corner and whether you look like me or not, you know?
So this is obviously not a spoken word album. It is an album of music.
Yeah.
So it seems worthy, you know, worthwhile to talk about the music for a minute. What musically were you going for in terms of the sound of the album?
I always want the music to represent whatever I'm speaking on. So when I pick beats, you know, I pick the beat before writing to it. You know, I don't write and then find a beat to match it, you know. Mm-hmm. I get the beat and then I go for it because I want the beat to kind of tell the story before I even jump on it. Mm-hmm. So I want the beat to be like, okay, this is what this is about. So you take a record like Black Sambo. Mm-hmm. It's energetic, it's fast, it's double time. Still melodic, still has this feel to it, feels kind of dark, but energetic, not dark in a somber way, dark but energetic. And it felt like police creeping. It felt like Trayvon walking through his neighborhood. It felt like, you know, Mike Brown. It felt like all these different things.
They said I'm Black Sambo, bright pink hoodie by the lamppost. Umbrella up that I can't close. You try to corner me, but I can't fold. Black Sambo.
And with that record, which started as a record, I was ghostwriting for somebody else. Ironically, Illmind played the beat. Mm-hmm. We're working on some records for some people who I obviously won't name.
Of course.
But we're working on some records for some people. And I came up with the idea. Mama said a little Black Sambo could never fit a crown. And then it kept going. And when I wrote it, I was like, I'm keeping this. You know, when I wrote the hook, dead ass, I wrote the hook for someone else. And I said, I'm keeping this.
Right.
And I told Lamont, I was like, bruh, I got to keep this and the beat. And he was like, absolutely. You know what I mean? Right. Like, absolutely. Like, that's yours. We'll make another record for such and such.
Yeah.
But it started as, you know, a record for someone else. And I fell in love with it so much. I said, I got to keep this. And I'm going to just finish writing it from my point of view now. But look at that record told me what to do. Mm-hmm. When I heard it, I heard that, you know. Same thing with Hoodie Season, because it took my concept to a totally different place and went left, you know. Same thing with all the records. So musically, I'm always looking for something that tugs, something warm, something that feels a certain way. I'm always looking for dirty drums, something that knocks. So you're always going to have drum breaks. You're always going to have that type of feel. And, you know, I always wanted to be in a certain space where you can hear what I'm saying, but more so feel what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. So
that makes sense. It seems like almost the way the record is sequenced, there's this little, you know, there's kind of a consistent sound, and then you have, you know, Love is Love.
Love me for overlooking what I ain't have to. Shows you when you didn't choose you when you had to. Pretend it never happened if mine should ever ask you. It wouldn't take much to revert to what your past knew.
Love is Love into Black Sambo. It's almost like a little two-song sort of detour mm-hmm. into like a different kind of sound.
Right.
Towards maybe, you know, it's two-thirds like of the way yeah. through the, mm-hmm. of the record. Can yeah. you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah. Love is Love literally told me what to do mm-hmm. because in the loop it's saying, love me, baby. And so the concept came from that and it was like, love me regardless of whatever. So I start speaking on all these things about myself, you know. Love me for overlooking what I ain't have to. I chose you when you didn't choose me, when you had to. You know, like all these different things that I'm speaking on. And it literally was just love me in spite of this, or love me because of this, mm-hmm. love me in celebration of this, and love me regardless of this, you know. And but when I say me, I'm talking about anybody listening, anybody who relates and feels a way.
Yeah.
And there's so many layers on there. That's one of my favorite records. That record was only supposed to be like a minute long.
This would be kind of an interlude.
Yeah, I was like, you know what, let's just make this a little quick minute and a half. And when I was writing, I was like, damn, I haven't stopped yet. I had so much more to say. It became a 4-minute record, you know, which is great. You know, no hook, just blow through. I was like, yeah, do like a little one and a half minute record.
Yeah.
Love me because of this, love me because of it. And I just had more shit to talk about loving me because. Mm. And it just, I was scrolling through the phone when I was writing. I was like, yeah, okay. And it, when I recorded it, it came out to be like 4 minutes, but I couldn't have been happier with it.
Yeah. So there's this great moment on Everybody's Fine mm-hmm. where you're going through the song and you reach the end of the lyrics and then you repeat the entire tune over a breakdown.
Everybody's fine. I said, really? They said, yeah. They said, celebratory moments of a glass or a bottle in the air or a flask and a shoddy with a flare and the bag coming out when one appears or the flash of a body in the stairs and the crash of a lobby in despair or...
What was your thinking there? What's supposed to kind of flip in the listener's mind hearing the lyrics the second time?
I just wanted people to get every single thing I was saying. Mm. You know, so much in that. And it's rocking and the beat is rocking and... and it's rocking and everything is dope and you're hearing the whole shit. I didn't want any excuses as to why you didn't catch everything I said because of the importance of it. Because I'm literally like, this, but everybody's fine. Mm-hmm. You know, if you ask certain people, everybody's fine, everything's cool, you know, everybody's fine. Now everybody's not fine. Like, this is where we are. But ironically, it's where we've been. It may be intensified on another level because of this clown who's in office and all these different things that go along with it. But this is where we've always been. Just turned the volume up louder, much louder. Volume just got turned up louder. This is always where it's been, you know? So I wanted people to hear every single word, you know, and be able to catch everything. And it's a long song because of me repeating the entire song twice.
Right.
But it makes it almost poetic, almost like spoken word, when you take the drums out and you just go over the loop and you go over the melody. And the way I'm saying it, I'm like on the beat, but I'm off the beat on purpose. Right. I did that on purpose because I wanted it to sound like a spoken word piece. I wanted it to sound like we were just kicking it. And I was maybe on a stage, or maybe I was sitting here with you and we were just conversing. And I said, this is what it is. And I just went into this whole spiel. And at the end of it, it's, but everybody's fine. And that's the sarcasm in it, you know?
Yeah. So the thing about this tune is you have these images of celebration right up against these images of violence.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
Sometimes there's the word or separating them, sometimes not. They're kind of thrown right together.
It's a celebratory moments of a glass or a bottle in the air or a flask and a shoddy with a flare and a bag coming out in one of pairs or the flash of a body in the stairs and the crash of a lobby in despair or...
What was the purpose of that?
I think it's what you kind of just broke down, you know? I feel like you kind of got it within asking it. The parallels, how close they are and how far apart they are, you know? Fists in the air over mistakes or fists in the air over the Jakes being vision impaired over a tray and that tray pound lift up the fear from out his face and you vision impaired over a wake. And it just goes into these different things like your fists in the air over mistakes, mistaken identity, or someone mistakenly, shooting, whatever it may be, and then fist in the air over the Jakes, being vision impaired over the track. It's just all these different layers of just kind of clashing, in a sense. You know, if you talk about the doctor part, you know, you talk about someone defying the odds and becoming a doctor, or, you know, whatever academia they're able to achieve and getting into a certain walk of life. Or the other side, Department of Corrections, the DOC versus the DOC. And then the parallels or lack thereof with those two things. It's all about how it can either go this way or this way. Yeah. Sometimes it's because of your own doing. Sometimes it isn't. A lot of times it isn't. And even at times when it is because of your own doing, it's based on things that had nothing to do with you.
Right.
And it's just a domino effect of it.
Yeah.
Whether it was 400 years ago or 10 years ago or yesterday.
Yeah.
It's a lot of that dichotomy. And that was the point of it.
A lot of your wordplay on a lot of the songs, you know, just talk about your rapping for a second since we haven't really delved into into that yet.
Yeah.
A lot of the wordplay on the record is sort of thematic. It's not like you're just making a pun because you thought of it and it's a cool
pun.
At all, yeah. Like, I'm thinking of sounds like you have all these puns on music-related terms, singing and note and all this kind of stuff.
So everything you get is in parts, it's like assignment. Part of it sound more like sitting under the floor. Might be enough to sit you above with all of your flaws like. And all of the applause is singing in uniform like. And then you take note what these harmonies can harm like. It sound like.
First off, do you have great puns that you think of that sometimes you have to leave on the cutting room floor because they don't fit thematically?
Yeah, totally. I'll come up with a crazy line and be like, but that doesn't fit. And I think what a lot of artists do is they'll throw that in there just because. Because it's dope. That's a dope line, but if they hear it, they're going to call me the greatest, da-da-da. I come up with 30 of those. So it's cool. I don't have to use that now. I can get that same effect while telling this story. Mm-hmm. And that's what I try to use to separate me as a writer and as an MC from a lot of people who get certain looks or accolades or put in a certain position or whatever it may be. My thing is what separates the boys from men, for lack of a better term, telling the story. And being able to tell a story in a way that's lyrical, that's poetic, that's bar-worthy, feels like a punchline even if it isn't, or if it blatantly is supposed to be, then it is. Entendres, layers, test of time, all those different things all culminate into one thing. And, you know, with this, like you said, what sounds like, which I, another one of my favorite records, especially lyrically, is what I was trying to do was set you up. It's like, okay, on Everybody's Fine, I tell you everything that's going on. Very next track sounds like where I'm pretty much letting you know what to expect on the next 13, 14 records, whatever it is. This is what it sounds like, you know? It sounds like a fist in the air meets a brick in the air meets baguettes meets the vision impaired. Or it sounds like visions impaired. And depending on how you pronounce both is what'll get to a pair.
It sound like rug money that turning the plug money that turning the overturning the plugs money.
And this, you know what I mean? Like, it's too, and it's not even to toot my own horn, but a lot of times I'll listen back to stuff or read back stuff after I wrote it and be like, God damn. Like, you know what I mean? Because, like, you take that line, it's just the only one I could think of off the head, but take that line, it sounds like a fist in the air. So you're talking this.
At this meeting, Sky was wearing a Black Panther Party jacket by Kenship. We'll have a photo of the jacket in the show notes.
Meets a brick in the air, meets, you know, getting work, getting a brick, getting, like, you know, you're in that world. The completion of, hey, I got it, now I can come up. I got what I need to turn my life into this, to make money for this time, whatever it is, the business that you're in, I got it. So it sounds like a fist in the air, meets a brick in the air, meets baguette diamonds, meets the vision impaired. Like, you got all that, but vision impaired heads can't see it. They can't appreciate it. So that goes on a lot of different levels, whether it's a literal level, baguettes meets the vision impaired. Like, oh, I can't even, you shining, I can't even see it because
right,
I can't see.
So bright. Yeah.
Or I can't see that because that's not what I'm into. That's not what I'm about, whatever it is. Or that doesn't matter. You being baguette it out doesn't matter to a cop out here. It may matter to a certain sect of people, a certain type of people, a certain crowd of people. But it doesn't matter to another set of people who could easily change and take your life away from you. And it's all those different types of layers, you know? Or sound like visions and pairs. Vision impaired, or sound like visions and pairs, meaning multiple people seeing how much you're shining, seeing how good you're doing. And depending on how you pronounce both is what'll get to appear, is what'll get to come into your life. Whether it's you losing your life or being in a position where your life is taken from you or your life isn't the way you want it to be or where your life is exactly the way you want it to be and it's gone beyond your wildest dreams. Depending on how you pronounce both is what'll get to appear. So a lot, it's all of that type of shit, man. And it just sets you up for what to expect for the next however many records are coming.
Yeah. And that depending on how you pronounce both thing is also kind of a sly joke about the fact that you're kind of the king of homophones, right? Of using words that sound the same,
the
but
king of
mean
it.
Different
that's
things.
It. Yeah. Word up.
Tell me, because that's something you do a lot on this record.
Catalog is like Avon, meets brother Muzan. Do y'all a three-peat and we about to part for it. Do either part for the part good. This what it sound like when you get a sound light. Just do say by the cases, do say what's the wages. And please do believe they do say what your name is for real.
And obviously you've done a lot in the past, but it seems like something you get like extra, have extra fun with here.
Yeah, I'm always pushing myself. always, regardless of whatever accolades I get, regardless of people's favorite rappers, you know, looking at me mm-hmm. as one of their favorites, regardless of the inspiration I've been able to give to up-and-comers or people who are on the radio. I mean, I've had Grammy Award-winning artists. I've had multi-platinum artists who changed the landscape of what's going on in this generation come to me and be like, dude, it was you. It was you who pushed me to go this way. Mm. It was your writing. I'm such a fan. You know, I've had all that go on, and I'm blessed to be able to say that. Regardless of all of that, I continue to push myself. You know, I want to one-up everything I've ever done every time I go in. Mm. I don't want there to be no debate that my current work is my best work. Now, you may favor something else because of the moment you were in when you heard it.
Yeah.
You know, music is all about time. That's why it's so big when somebody calls something a classic, because of the time they were in and how it stood the test of time. Yeah. If you're in a certain place when you hear a record for the first time, whenever you hear that record moving forward, you're going to go back to that place mentally and emotionally. That's just the way the science of human nature works.
Yeah.
So with that being said, an older album may be a favorite of yours, a personal favorite, because of where you were when you heard it or what you were going through. I've had people tell me they were in a hospital bed, you know, going through cancer or going through this, that, and the third when they heard A Dream Deferred or The Salvation, or they were getting ready to go to jail when they heard music from my friends. Mm. But there will not be a debate on technically, lyrically, what my best work is. My best work is going to be my current work, because I am always pushing to one-up myself and beat whatever I did yesterday, you know?
Jay, you know, Jay-Z, obviously someone you've referenced a lot throughout your career.
Yeah.
You know, someone else, another rapper from Brooklyn, obviously he and Big are kind of touchstones to you.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of explicitly set him up as a touchstone on this record, right? You have that line about, like, the best you've heard since he was hollering chair.
Hopping up for high like I got it by the leader. And you ain't heard better since some was hollering Chia. Cheer me on, look at the tear I be on. I done been acclaimed so long, I'm Claire Beyond.
Music. Ha, you caught that.
Yeah. So tell me about Jay and what he represents to you at this point in your life.
For me, obviously continuing to push the envelope, push the line further, go for it in a certain way, one-up yourself, obviously. The competitive nature, right? Mm-hmm. Competitive nature of being a fan of somebody, but also wanting to one-up them, especially when you hear their latest work. Because that's how it all goes. That's how we all grow up. You know, you hear somebody record, even if it's your friend, you hear somebody record, they get busy, and you're excited. You're like, ooh, they killed that. Ooh, all right, my next joint, boom, I'm going to crush that. And you're not directly going at that person, but it's something that gets your gears moving, right? So that's that. But also, for me, I think, especially with his newest work and kind of where he's at in life, I think it's made everyone more acceptable as far as, it's made everyone more accepting as far as growing up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm someone who's never shied away from that. You know, I'm not 48, you know, I'm not, you know, there yet. Mm-hmm. I'm in my 30s, you know, I'm 35, but I've never shied away from my age or who I am or where I'm at. I'm still young, whatever it may be. But I've never shied away from the responsibilities that come with being an adult. Mm. So I can't be 35 and trap it out. I can't color my hair. I can't wear long john pants. I can't. I got a kid, you know, and I can't do that. But it doesn't mean I have to be 60-year-old rap. Like, it doesn't mean that either. Mm. There's a place and a space that I think still resonates with the youth, because if it didn't, I wouldn't have 18 and 19-year-olds at my shows. I wouldn't have 20-year-olds DMing me about how much the records changed their life and how much they love it and how they've been listening to me since they were, you know, 13 and now they're 20, you know, like it still resonates, you know. But as far as him, I think just that competitive nature, but also that fandom, you know, I'm always going to be a fan of what he's done and what he's doing, as long as what he's doing is what I dig, you know, and so far so good. So that's not, you know, there's no worry there. I think that's how we all got to be with the artists that we love.
Yeah.
Let's hold them accountable. So far, so good. Obviously, he's, you know, had an illustrious career and everything he's done. But for me, it's the competitive nature and the enjoyment of where he's at the same time.
Yeah. And way back in the beginning of the conversation, you mentioned Illmatic, mm-hmm. which is possibly the only, I certainly could have missed some, but possibly the only work that gets direct reference on this album. You use the Taylor Rock sample as kind of like a nod to The World Is Yours.
It's like, this is yours, right? Forever and then a day.
It's mine, it's mine, it's mine.
And then I think there's one other one other time where you interpolate a Nas line on this record.
Probably. I don't remember off top, but
yeah,
probably.
Yeah.
As true as the religion, concealing your 45, four fives and gauges, max and fact, it's with
four fives and gauges, max and fact, same niggas that catch you back to back, snatching your cracks and black.
Why Illmatic?
Greatest hip-hop album ever. Mm-hmm. For me, as someone who makes hip-hop albums, someone who feels that my work is some of the greatest work ever, greatest hip-hop album ever. For me, I always tell people, if someone came from another country, another planet, or whatever type of hypothetical extreme we could come up with, and they literally had never heard hip-hop before, and they said, what is hip-hop? I would just give them that and walk away, you know? I think that's the best place to start. Mm. It's about outside, it's about the urban community and coming up, it's about from nothing to something. It's sample ridden, it's sample riddled, it's all littered with samples, mm-hmm. and the drums, the energy, the youth of it, the poetic side of it, the poetry within it, it is the perfect culmination of an introduction to hip hop for someone who may have never heard the two words hip and hop put together. So for me, greatest hip-hop album of all time, no debates.
And, you know, speaking of people who listen to hip-hop and maybe, you know, aren't so aware of where it comes from, that's another theme on the album. You talk several times about people who listen to rap but don't really understand or even necessarily care about people who make it.
Cultural appropriation is all over this album.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Maybe most clear in Heirlooms and Accessories.
Yep. You get the running like, fuck it. It's probably safest to just live it off a playlist and tell us I provided inspiration. I'm inspired by knowing that paths really work. Shots really turn.
Couple other places as well.
Yeah.
What inspired you to talk about that? Let's start there.
It's a reality that no one talks about. Yeah. And I think when people talk about it, they get looked at as either the old man on the porch saying, get off my lawn, mm-hmm. or they get looked at as, oh, he's a backpacker, he's a underground. If a rapper was to say that, oh, he's lost, he's not in the time. No, you're lost, because here's why. This is us. Now, granted, any and everyone can come in and enjoy it and get involved and contribute to it. We've had some amazing contributions from people who don't look like me. Eminem, one. Big Pun, Fat Joe. We've had some amazing contributions from people who don't look like me. So that's not to sit here and be that guy to say it's only ours and stay away. Not at all. I would never do that with any art form. You know, artists for people, period. You know, but at the same time, the cultural appropriation of not being from where it's from, which is fine, not understanding what it is, but acting like you do, being paid to act like you do, and then having this holier-than-thou feel to you and this holier-than-thou energy to you when you turn your nose and look down on those who are from it and who are doing it greatly, mind you. Now, if it's trash, it's trash, but people who are doing it greatly, mind you, and you deciding that it is not real because to you, you think that it doesn't represent the culture. Mm-hmm. It's not yours. Like, you know what I mean? It's not from you, you know? You can enjoy it, be a part of it, contribute to it. How can I tell an Italian family what is or isn't real Italian food? I can never dare utter those words. Now, I could have a preference over some over the others. How can I tell them that they're not representing their culture, their heritage, their country the right way? Mm-hmm. I'm not that. All I can do is respect and appreciate what they're doing and who they are and learn more about it from them. I couldn't dare do that, whether it's Italian, Jewish, whatever it may be. I'm using that as an example.
Yeah.
Couldn't dare do that. But you have a lot of critics, writers, media, websites, whatever it is, festivals, whose job is to put things together that represent the culture and feel like they can dictate what is and is not the culture when they are not from the culture and they aren't the culture. Mm-hmm. To me, that is a huge problem, because if the tables were turned, they would have a huge problem if it was us,
right.
You know? And it's something that never gets talked about. And the few times that it does get talked about usually isn't in the music. It's in dialogue and conversation. So then you get looked at as a hater. You get looked at as, oh, you're mad at such and such website because you're not on it. I don't give a fuck about being on such and such website. But for me, I'm not going to stand by and watch what me and mine built to be torn down by someone who really could care less about it and is there for a check. Or is there to mock it, whether they know they're mocking it or not.
Right.
Is there to kind of champion and campaign for everything that is wrong with it, for all of the stuff that you know, even the people who the culture is supposed to represent, obviously there's tons going on that's wrong within hip hop. Tons. Plethora. That's a whole another hour long conversation.
Right.
But to champion that, but then turn your nose up or not give coverage to what is right about it. You like this and that and whatever it's doing? Okay, cool. Music is all opinion. It's all subjective. Okay, cool. You like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
But to sit here and not spotlight this as well, when you know it's representing what the culture always was and what it's supposed to be, to not give that balance and to act like that's not real, to act like that's not a reality and that's not a great thing, and to act like that shouldn't be covered because it doesn't represent the culture, and this does, I mean, like, what kind of slap in the face is that? And then to get paid to do it, you know?
Interesting, yeah. So you see it as a problem, kind of, there's this three sort of related things, right? There's the media, there's maybe artists, and then mm-hmm. there's kind of the fans. And the fans is the one that's actually, like, you most literally talk about on the album,
mm-hmm.
right? When you have this idea of, like, the sort of fans with rich white fathers who are using slang but don't necessarily understand what it means or
right,
where
right.
it comes
on
from.
Love is love. Yeah,
on Love is Love.
Mm-hmm. And it's orchestrated all from the other side of the fence. And they love me like that side of the fence, love bottom lines. While they kids call they friends kids and they holler slime. And they don't get the gist, but they get what it could provide. And they still don't know how to pronounce collards, but it's fine. Love me for not a soul.
What was behind that image?
It's the reality of that, the fact that that's a reality,
mm-hmm.
you know. Again, granted, what I want to continue to stress is that it's not about don't deal with hip-hop or our culture if you don't look like, no, not at all, not at all.
Yeah.
I tour Europe 5-6 times a year, you know, that is one of my biggest bases, and I love it, and I love everyone out there. I love the fact that they can relate to it even though they don't look like it, mm-hmm. even though they've never been to Brooklyn, or they may have never been pulled over by police because of what they look like. I love the fact that they can relate to the music regardless because they see themselves in a certain way. I absolutely love, honor, and cherish that. But at the same time, you have certain people like what I described and what you broke down in the lyric. You have that type of world. And the irony of with that lyric where I'm talking about a certain side of the fence that's set up and dictates a certain thing. And then in behind this closed doors, their kid is all about that same thing that you're sitting there trying to tear down subliminally, or that you're trying to tear down in your own way, and that you're orchestrating to bring down to the ground. Your kid is a fan of that, but your kid doesn't even understand what it really is, but he's a fan of it because it's the cool thing. There's so many arms and branches to this tree, you know, and that's what I wanted to get into in that four bars or whatever it was on that record.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is a different, kind of a more nuanced take on it than, you know, you'd had in the past, which would be like, hey, your father's a racist, but your kid loves rap.
Right.
Like, he's come, you know, your time has passed.
Right.
And this is a little more nuanced than that.
And you rhymed, like, there, too.
Oh.
You said, you know, time has passed, rap. Yeah, you rhymed a little bit.
This is a little more nuanced than that, mm-hmm. and saying, like, just because the kid is aware of certain aspects of black music, it doesn't mean that prejudice is going away and, like, the old days are past.
And I think the reason for putting it that way for me is it's more nuanced than that because it's more nuanced than that in the lyric, because it's more nuanced than that in life and in the subject, right?
Right.
It's not as simple as it's this and it's that. It's never as simple as that in human nature, you know? So for us, it's more layered than that. So my job as a writer touching on this subject is to lay those layers out, for lack of a better term, and describe all that. Like, that is my job, as opposed to just say, you know, your father's a racist, but you're listening, or your father's responsible for this, but you're a fan, and that, ha-ha, like, it's not about that. And that's not poetic enough for me, but it's not about that, you know? It's way more layered than that, you know? In a funny way, it's kind of like the scene in Half-Baked, and I wouldn't think about it till just now, but with Dave Chappelle is talking about different customers he has, and then he has the father smoking, and he's like, little does he know, Billy in the next room is smoking. And the father's dressed up all studious, and then the son is dressed up with his hat backwards or whatever it is, and they're blowing. He's like, he's wondering what they have in common.
We call this kid the after-school special smoker. He spends all of his allowance on reefer. Thanks, little buddy. Now, in the next room is father, and I'm 40, but I'm still cool smokers, token up, trying to figure out a way to bond with his son. Isn't that ironic? Don't you think? Of course, across town, the kid's nana's smoking up, trying to ease her glaucoma.
And it's good for arthritis, too.
It kind of feels like that in a different way, even though the father's behind certain aspects of it going one way and the kid is in another. Little do they know they're possibly a part of the same thing, in the same thread, you know?
Yeah. I want to talk about the stick-up tape from Menace and movies more particularly.
Okay.
Because you mentioned there is a large part of your life that mirrors Boys in the Hood.
Yeah.
And it seems like a lot of these, you know, movies from that same period, the Boys in the Hood, the Menace, the Juice, seem like more than movies to you in a way. You've obviously rapped about Juice a whole ton of times and, you know, all this stuff. Why do those movies have such staying power for you?
Relatability, the stories and the writing being a real thing that I know. Mm-hmm. You know, like when I did Steel's Apartment, back on Dream Deferred, my friends were like, you know, Juice. You know, I was the one making music, like Q. I was trying to make music, you know, as a kid. I was the one who was that. We had a wild cowboy like Bishop, and it was just a group of us, and we were just trying to figure it out.
All of this intrigue will make you leave from out of these doors and look for where Quillis is. Bigger dreams penciled in, Hennessy adrenaline. Throw down, stand up and die for it like Blizzard did.
That was it, and I think that's every kid coming up, especially looking like me. You look like me and you're from where I'm from. You're just trying to figure it out, you know? Yeah. And, you know, so that was that. But with the stick-up tape from Menace, man, that's an idea I had for so long, but I sat on it. I think I had that idea in, like, 2011. I never wrote it, you know, ahead of time because I write everything in the moment. So I sat on the idea. I had the concept for a long time. And I was like, man, that, you know, and it came from the Jay-Z line on the Girls, Girls, Girls remix.
Of course.
Kane and Old Dog, the stick-up tape from Menace.
Slow down, but for now I get around. Like the late Machiavelli or Pirelli 20 inches of Kane and Old Dog, stick-up tape from Menace. You tell them chicks if...
And even though that was just a brief line in the song where he's rapping about females, I took that line to mean something totally different. You know, Old Dog, Kane and Old Dog, the stick-up tape from Menace. And when I heard that, I was just like, and it stuck. And I just came up with this concept of what that moment in that movie meant and how it played out. I mean, the movie starts with that and how it played out to this entire chain of events that changed everyone's lives. All because there was a conversation because of some confusion on race, confusion on classism, and confusion on people walking in a store and what you think their agenda is and their motive is. And it changed everyone's lives. And for me, you look at how Old Dog was selling the tape in the hood and showing the tape to everyone goes back to validation. So that record in particular, you know, on the surface, people are going to think I made a record about Menace to Society. That's cool. Anyone could have made a record about Menace to Society. This is what happens and this is what... But I didn't do that because the record's not about Menace to Society. The record's about validation. It uses Menace to Society as a vehicle to describe the ills of putting so much importance on validation in the wrong way.
Invalidation is everything that you knew it was. Your fingerprints on a bottle, but they ain't proving much. For the importance of needing importance, until it's loud enough with somebody seeing you for it and calling for everything you did it for.
The record is about validation, 100%. And I use the tape as, you know, that tape means so much. But what does it really mean? Was it really worth putting that on tape, getting the tape, showing everyone the tape instead of, okay, it was smart to take the tape so that you're not incriminated, but was it worth showing everyone so you are now incriminated? Like, was it worth the chain of events just for the celebrity of the moment, of that summer? That's all validation. And that all stems back from everything that we have systematically been through and how it will never change. I mean, too much has been done. So it's like you dig the hole too deep to get out of. It won't change. It's just about how to combat it a certain way to survive it. But it won't change, you know?
And it seems like in some ways, and I think you hint at this in the song, if I'm reading it right, these ideas of validation and people who you don't know seeing you and thinking of you a certain
exactly.
way.
And caring about that.
It plays into your career as a performer.
Yeah, that's a dope way to put it.
Yeah.
Super dope way to put it. The validation that even we as artists look for, and obviously the record wasn't about that, but the validation that we as artists look for. And with us, it's a business, right? Like, if we're not validated, we may not be able to keep lights on. We have to go get a job or whatever. So I have to remain that way. I haven't had a job in, I don't know, 12, 13 years or something like that, thank God. But, like, you know, if I am not continuously in a certain space, then I can't be in a certain space. Like, I got to go to another space and clock in, and I refuse to do that at this point. So you know, that's a super dope way to put it, because validation is such a real thing for everyone, right? It's why everyone's on the gram selfied out. It's why people buy followers on Snapchat.
Notably, just 3 days after this conversation, the New York Times would run a big story called The Follower Factory about companies that sell fake social media followers.
It's why that is what it is. But for my people, it is something that existed before any of the above was ever thought of. It is something that existed since day one when they said, hey, come over here, let me talk to you. And we wound up being on a boat. You know, like, it is something that existed since then. You know, validation, everything. And that's a scary subject.
Sure. Beyond all the things we've talked about, what do you want people to know going into listening to A Celebration of Us?
What I want people to know, what I want people to know and what I want them to get. So first off, what I want them to know is what I was trying to do with this record as far as representing me and mine. But in turn, representing everyone, right? It's about celebrating who we are in every way. But it's also about being realistic about who we are for better and worse. So the better, cool. But the worse also. It's why there's a part on there, there's a skit that I found online where, you know, on the end of Collateral, where it's like, you know, things black people like, in a way, we go. Seeing black families win on Family Feud. Seeing this, doing that, doing this, doing that.
Without further ado, things black people like, and away we go. Hoodies, basketball, track and field, being black, Henny, going to the club, Go-Go's, promoting their music on SoundCloud, Spinrilla, eating unhealthy, Obama, Jays, slanting their hats, oodles of noodles, those are good as shit.
That stuff is so important because, you know, for me, that little skit was like the biggest slap in the face. It's like mocking who we are and what we celebrate. But then when you get to why we celebrate some of these things, you'll understand why we celebrate some of these things. You get to who we are as a people. Like, I love my people. Even some of the things we do, you know, I'll laugh. I'll be like, man, I love black people so much. Like, something, you know, we'll do something. We'll see something in the news, on the media, whatever. And I'll just bust out. I love my people so much. Because only we would do that. Because when you dig deeper into why we would do that, then you really get it. And you understand it. So going back to the question, I want people, whether you're black or not, I want people to get that. I want people to get the importance of that. And that's what I want people to take away from it and to know the reason why I did it was it needed to be done. It's the most layered album of my career thus far. And I truly believe if I wanted to, and I have no plans on doing so, but if I wanted to leave it there, I could totally just leave it there and be like, I'm done. And this was the last thing that represents my stamp, my legacy, my logo, my flag in the dirt. Boom, there it is. You know, and I wanted to do something that represented me and mine, and it came full circle to being this guidebook for my kid, you know?
It sounds like a great place to end, Sky. Yeah. Thank you for
my man
talking to me about the record.
Absolutely, absolutely. Word up. All right.
I'm honored that Sky Zoo chose me for this endeavor. When you listen to the album, you'll undoubtedly hear everything we discussed, and also a whole lot more that you'll wish we did. In Celebration of Us is a really special project, and I'm proud to have played a part in bringing it out into the world. Make sure to follow Sky Zoo on social media to find out when and where to check out the video of this talk so you can see Mike's for yourself. Join us in 2 weeks when we talk to Rhymesayers artist Evidence. Evidence, who came to the world's attention as a member of Dilated Peoples, has a new solo album out called Whether or Not. We talk about that, growing up in LA, how he developed his unique style, and why this record will end his trilogy of weather-related projects. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cypher as soon as it comes out, subscribe on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast app you use. Make sure you check out our archives when you're there. If you like this episode, you should listen to our talk with Sky Zoo's barrel brother, Torre, on episode 139. By the way, if you use Apple's podcast to listen, go now and give us a rating and a review. It's by far the easiest way to help us out, which is why every podcast you listen to wants you to do it. Seriously, go now and do it. And you can really help us by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. Bringing you each episode takes at least 20 hours of work, and we could really use the support. If even 20% of you gave us just $1 a month, I could afford to bribe Sky to find out the names of his ghostwriting clients. Seriously, there's gotta be some Grammys in there. As an added bonus for our patrons, we try every month to share bonus audio that we get from our guests, either while talking to them after the main interview is over, or sometimes when they give us some extra special material. We've had behind-the-scenes production stories, unreleased Wu-Tang, and all sorts of things you can never find anywhere else, even on our regular episodes. Join us by the end of February to have access to March's file. And again, go buy a shirt, a mug, or whatever you want at merch.thecyphershow.com. You can find us at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Follow us and let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see on the show in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotaro.
And I saw him go in with his city bike in the building.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
Old man on the porch saying, get off my lawn.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
Here's what happened. Here's how he changed everything.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
I don't know what it's like to be a woman.
Audio editing by Rob Van Vranken.
I know what's up. I'm a fan. Word. Okay, appreciate it.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Devin McKenzie.
Man, Lucy's a Lucy. Yeah, right. It's 25 cents.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Trying to not stare at the camera for the whole time.